Let Doc know before you do, in case you get sick. It should be fine, though. This river is clean. There's no human habitation, no farming or nothing. Only one bridge over it, and anything that's washed off in that area there has been flushed out by now. Good. Then I'm going mussel hunting. Thad stood up. I'm going to clean these fish and see what Miss Mel has planned for dinner. Do me a favor and tell her I went to talk to the old man about tomorrow. He gave me a thumbs up as he walked away. I walked along the river to Sarge's cabin. He and the guys were sitting out front on ammo cans. Hey, Morg, glad you're here, Sarge said as I pulled up a can and sat down. We're leaving early, way ahead of our meeting. I want to be out there and have eyes on the place when they show up. Whatever you need. Sarge handed me a stick. Can you sketch out the place? Give us an idea of where we're going? I smoothed the dirt with my boot. Sure. I drew a big circle, then a line above it, and one on the left intersecting it. On the left side of the circle, I drew an X. Pointing at the circle, I said, "This is the lake," then pointed at the top line. "This is Highway 40. Then to the left line, and this is Highway 19. I pulled the line for 19 down farther, then drew another X past the lake. This first X is the antenna where you're supposed to meet, and this second one, I stabbed the stick into the X, is the camp. Sarge's brow furrowed as he looked at the drawing.
Kinda close to the bad guys, Ted said.
Real close, Sarge said. Morg, you can get us there without using the paved roads, right? Using the stick, I drew another meandering line off the back of the lake, angling away from 19. There's a trail back here we can use that cuts through the woods. We'll have to cross one paved road and some dirt roads, but it'll keep us far from this mess over here. I tapped the X for the camp. How far you reckon it is? It's probably 20 miles the way we're going. We need to leave early, then. I want to be on the trail by 0300. We'll take both buggies. Sarge looked at Mike. Bring your 203. Ted, you take my M1A. There will be a saw on each vehicle as well. We'll find a place to stage our rides. Two of us will stay with them, and three of us move into a position where we can watch the area for them to show up. Doc, you and Mike will stay with the rides. I don't want you out there if there's any shooting. We might need your hands.
I thought you said there wasn't going to be any shooting, I said.
Morg, one thing you learn in this business is never assume anything. Ted will take up a position where he can cover us with the M1. You and me will go out and talk.
Why me?
I jabbed my thumb toward the small circle. Any of these guys are infinitely better when the lead starts to fly than me.
You said you might know these old boys.
I don't know about that. Last time I saw those guys, only one of them walked away. They might have some hard feelings toward me.
Ted looked up.
Did you kill any of them?
No. I tried to help them, get them to take cover, but they ran out and started shooting at that damn helicopter.
Don't worry, you'll be all right. Go on and get some rest. I'll rattle your cage at 0230.
I nodded and got up.
See you then.
On the way back to my cabin, I stopped by Danny's. He and Bobby were sitting in camp chairs under a big live oak. Mel and the girls were there, too.
Sorry to hear about the house, man, I said.
Danny made a whatever gesture with his face.
We knew it would happen.
At least they didn't burn it down, Bobby said.
Yet, Danny added.
I'm going with Sarge in the morning. He needs me to guide him somewhere. Can you keep an eye on Mel and the girls?
Mel looked up.
I can keep an eye on myself, thank you very much.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, I ain't going anywhere.
I thought you said you weren't going to run around and play soldier anymore, Bobby said, looking to Mel.
Oh, thanks for that. I'm not. It's just to meet some guys and talk.
Can I come?
It was Taylor.
Sorry, kiddo, you can't.
Why not?
Mel looked up.
Yeah, if it's just a meeting, why not?
Well, fuck me running. I didn't have a good comeback to that, so I tried deflection instead. I don't know if Sarge would want her along.
You don't work for him. Take her along,
Mel said, an edge in her voice. I knew what she was doing, trying to get me to back out of the deal entirely, so I called her bluff.
Okay, you can come.
Really? Taylor asked, with a big smile.
Yeah, it's just a ride in the woods. Why not?
I want to go, Daddy, Little Bit shouted. Mel looked at her.
No, you're too little. You're staying here with me.
She kicked the dirt. I never get to do anything. Mel was obviously pissed about the plan, but there was nothing she could do. I gestured to Taylor.
Come on, then. You and I have to get a little sleep before dinner. We leave at 3 in the morning.
She and I both headed to the cabin to take naps. A few hours later, we got up and ate dinner with everyone. Mel had cooked fish in a Dutch oven, with some rehydrated vegetables and potatoes served over rice. While a very basic meal, it was good and filling. Over dinner, Mel told everyone that the food stocks were running out, that we needed to find other sources besides the MREs. Everyone agreed, and Jeff and Thad said they would help launch an expedition, which helped her mood a little bit. After dinner, I went back to try and lay down for a while, though I knew I wouldn't sleep well. Sometime later, Mel came in and lay down. She put her arm over me and laid there without saying anything. I held her hand, and together, we drifted off to sleep. Chapter 35. Before I knew it, I woke up to Sarge beating on the side of the cabin. It was like some bad deja vu.
I'm up, knock it off. Hurry up!
Taylor sat up, rubbing sleep from her eyes.
Is it time?
Yeah, get dressed. Mel stirred but didn't wake, so I left her alone, as I got dressed and put on all the hardware by the light of the flashlight. Once we were dressed, I handed Taylor a camo shirt. Put this on. I picked up my rifle and handed Taylor hers, along with a small shoulder bag of magazines. Kneeling down beside Mel, I kissed her head and said I'd be back.
You better. And take care of Taylor, too.
I will. It'll be all right.
Love you, Mom, Taylor said.
The guys were waiting at the buggies. Sarge looked at Taylor when we walked up, and I braced myself for what I was sure to be some interesting verbal abuse. To my surprise, he didn't bat an eye.
I got coffee. Want some?
Sarge asked.
Sure, why not? I said.
Me too, please, Taylor said.
Sarge looked at her.
You drink coffee?
Taylor nodded, and I said,
like a bubblehead.
What's a bobblehead?
Sarge handed her a cup.
They're crazy people that go under the ocean in big black coffins.
She didn't get it.
Submariners. Sailors on submarines.
Oh, she said, as she took a sip of the coffee, then immediately spit it out.
Ugh, what is that?
Coffee, Sarge replied.
Where's the sugar and creamer?
Sugar and creamer? Where do you think you are? Starbucks?
Oh, I can't drink this, she said, and went to pour it out. Sarge grabbed the cup.
Hey, little lady, don't pour it out. There's precious little of this stuff.
That's just nasty. I don't know how you drink it.
It's an acquired taste, Ted said,
taking a sip of his.
Saddle up, everyone. Morgan, you'll drive my buggy.
I got in, and Sarge handed me a pair of night vision goggles.
Here, no lights.
The route we were taking was way out in the forest, in a rather remote area. The roads through the Ocala National Forest consist almost entirely of deep sugar sand, which is very fine and, unfortunately, means it is easy to get stuck. The other kind of roads were mud holes, which are exactly what they sound like. Today, we would take both to ensure the safest route. We drove in silence mostly. We did have a moment of levity, though. At one particularly muddy crossing, I had to gun the engine a bit, and the tires threw mud all over Taylor. She took it like a champ, though, and didn't complain, laughing as she wiped some of the splatter from her face. It even got the old man chuckling a bit. After about 30 minutes of driving through the forest, we approached the lake from the south side. Heading west, I drove slowly. At this point, We were closer to the camp than ever, and I wanted to be aware of our surroundings, since the sun was already coming up. It was coming on 5:30 when I caught the first glimpse of the antenna and pointed it out to Sarge.
"Let's see if we can get close enough to put this mast up and take a look with the camera."
I started easing closer, while Sarge looked for a place where we'd have a shot at seeing the sight. He told me to stop and pulled the small camera console up in front of him. The hydraulic pump that raised it sounded loud enough to wake the dead. I leaned in through the driver's side to check the camera. It was set to thermal, and we could see the antenna and the small building under it. Sarge panned the camera back and forth. The only thing we saw was a lonely armadillo rooting around in the woods beside the building.
"All right, Mike, you and Doc stay here. Keep an eye on this, and let me know when they show up. They'll probably be in a blazer. Ted, you and Morgan, come with me."
Sarge handed out the small radios to each of us.
"What about me?" Taylor asked.
"You stay here. Don't wander off, just stay with the buggies," I said. A small road ran in front of the antenna. At a small bend in it, Ted dipped off into the bush, about 50 yards from the site where Sarge told me to find some cover.
"Stay in there. I'll go out first, and if it's clear, I'll wave to you."
"All right," I said, as I walked off into the scrub.
"Keep your eyes open."
I gave him a thumbs up and moved as quietly as I could through the tangle of brush until I found a large log lying on the ground with a palmetto in front of it. I laid down on my stomach and took a camo face mask out of my vest and pulled it over my head. We had a long time to wait, the sort of thing that takes patience, something I don't have. As the sky lightened, I was able to see more around me. I soon got bored and started poking ants on the log with a stick. Every minute or two, I would look up. My ears were always listening for the telltale snapping of a twig or brushing sound of someone walking through the palmettos, but in this case, silence was a soundtrack to this leg of our adventure. Once the sun was up, I heard Sarge's voice in the little earpiece.
"Everyone good?"
Mike immediately replied that there was no movement by them. I keyed my mic and told him I was 10-4. Then it was silent again. Eventually, I had to roll over on my back and stretch my shoulders and back by doing small crunches. I was not made to lie prone like this for so long. I don't know how those snipers do it. Noon was a long ways away. During one of Sarge's radio checks, I asked Mike about Taylor. He said she was sleeping in the back seat of the buggy. I smiled. That kid could sleep anywhere. Not long after that call, Mike came back over the radio.
"We've got a truck inbound with 2 outriders on ATVs."
"Roger that. Let me know what they do," Sarge replied.
After several minutes, he came back on the radio.
"They've stopped. Looks like the ATVs are going to provide security. They're moving. You should see them any second now."
"Roger that."
There was a pause.
"I got them."
The old K-5 Blazer pulled right up to the building and stopped. 4 men got out. 1 went to the back and opened the rear gate, letting a 5th man out.
"I got eyes on 5 bodies," Sarge said.
"Roger, I count 5, Ted replied.
"I've got 5, Mike said.
I pulled my binoculars from my pack so I could get a good look at them. One of them looked familiar, but it was really his rifle that jogged my memory. I keyed my radio.
"Sarge, the guy with the scoped long gun is the survivor from the Hilo attack."
"Roger that. You stay put. I'm coming out."
I couldn't see Sarge until he started down the trail. The men didn't see him right away. He walked a good 20 yards before one of them pointed him out. While they had their weapons in their hands, they didn't make aggressive movements, which was a relief. I kept the binoculars on them regardless, carefully looking each man over. The 5th guy, the one that got out of the back, had caught my attention. He was bandaged in several places, with one arm in a sling. He also wasn't dressed like the rest of them. The other four men were all wearing Woodland BDU military uniforms. He was wearing what looked like a uniform, but more like what the Department of Corrections would issue. This, and the fact that he wasn't armed, really made him stand out from the pack. One of them, Calvin, waved and started to walk toward Sarge. They met in the road and spoke for a moment, Calvin gesturing back to the bandaged man leaning on the truck. After a minute or two of talking, Sarge keyed his radio.
"Come on out, Morgan."
I was more than happy to oblige and quickly got up, only to find out I was so stiff I could hardly walk. Holy hell, I'm getting too old for this shit. It didn't help to realize that Sarge's old ass had lain there just as long as I had, so I sucked it up and made my way out of the scrub as fast as I could.
"Hey, Calvin," I said with a nod.
"Morgan," he replied.
"You boys come on up here. I think you'll want to meet the feller we brought."
As we walked to the truck, I saw a familiar face.
"Hey, Daniel," I said, eliciting some strange looks from the others.
"Morgan, remember? We met out on the river. You guys found me sleeping under a tree."
"Oh, yeah, I remember you. Did you ever make it home?"
"Yeah, I made it. How've things been for you guys?"
"It was rough, you know. Things are getting a little better."
He paused for a moment.
"It's good you made it. I wondered about you. This here's Omar," Calvin said. "He escaped from the camp."
That got Sarge's attention.
"We found him out in the woods. He's pretty shot up, but we nursed him back to health."
"How'd you get out?" Sarge asked.
"They were going to transfer us. Me and a couple of others stole the bus and tried to get away."
"What happened?"
"We didn't get far. They chased us and shot the bus all to hell. Everyone tried to run. Most were gunned down in the road. I got to the woods and hid. They searched, and I was sure they were going to find me, but they didn't. I saw some shit, though. They caught a bunch of people, lined them up, and shot them right there in the woods."
"Just executed them?" I asked.
"Shot them down like dogs."
"What do you mean they were going to transfer you? Transfer to where?" Sarge asked.
"They have, what's the word they use, pacified parts of some cities. They're moving people into them. They assign you a place to live and have a job. That's why they're trying to bring people into the camps. Once you're in, you can't get out until they resettle you, as they call it."
"How long were you in the camp?"
"About a month."
Sarge rubbed his chin.
"You know the layout?"
"Yeah, real good. My job was on the trash detail, so I've been in every tent and building there. Well, almost all of them."
"Almost?" Sarge asked.
"There's a section where they take people who they deem a threat or who violate the rules. I never went in there."
"Could you draw me a map of the place?"
Calvin reached into the blazer and pulled a piece of folded paper off the dash.
"Here, I thought you'd want one." So we sat down with him and drew it up.
Sarge unfolded the map, looking at it.
"To scale, even.
Those distances are pretty accurate. I'm a surveyor. I know distance," Omar added.
"I appreciate this. It's really going to help us out," Sarge said.
"No problem. Anything I can do to help. They treated everyone like damn prisoners in there. It's a bad place.
I had a feeling you might be up to something around here. When it kicks off, if you need any help, just let us know," Calvin said.
"I'll certainly keep that in mind."
Sarge stuck his hand out to Calvin.
"Thanks for the info."
They shook hands, and we started back toward the buggies. Behind us, I heard the blazer start up and drive off.
"You think it's legit?" I asked.
Sarge looked at the map.
"Sure seems so to me."
Chapter 36. Fred was dealing cards to herself.
"I think you need to be there. Don't you want to see the SOB get what he deserves?"
Jess sat cross-legged on her bunk, chewing on a hangnail.
"I do, but I'm afraid. What if he sees me?"
"He won't. You'll be in the kitchen. You can watch from there."
Jess looked at Mary. I think you should, too. I just hope it works, Mary said nervously.
It'll work, trust me. Fred held up the cup with the strained liquid.
I pour this in his coffee, and he's as good as dead.
You going to cook it tonight? Mary asked.
Yeah, after the kitchen closes.
Okay, I'll do it, I'll go, Jess said, staring at the floor.
I want to see that son of a bitch fall over dead. I just wish I could spit in his face.
Good. You wait. His ass is grass.
They spent the rest of the afternoon napping and playing cards. Their dinner was once again brought to them, and Jess ate for the first time in nearly 2 days. Fred waited until a few hours after the kitchen closed before carrying the trays back. She slipped in and lit the stove, setting her can over the gas burner. It didn't take long for the liquid to start boiling. She watched it as it bubbled, slowly thickening. Once it looked like a puddle of Hershey syrup in the bottom of the can, she turned off the heat and picked it up with a rag. She took it to the dry goods storage and hid it behind a stack of cans of dehydrated potatoes. After checking to make sure everything was in order, she headed back to the room.
Where is it? Mary asked when she came in.
I hid it in the kitchen. It would look a little weird for me to be carrying it to work in the morning, wouldn't it? Jess was already asleep. Fred looked at her and murmured, I can't wait to see the look on that bastard's face when he dies.
The next morning, they walked silently over to the kitchen.
Kay was already there, as usual. When she saw Jess, she walked over.
You sure you feel up to this?
Yeah. Lying in bed feeling sorry for myself isn't going to help any. Kay smiled.
All right, sweetie. You just stay back here.
Jess worked on the normal breakfast preps, getting food ready. She could feel the other women looking at her. They know what happened to me, she thought, trying to ignore their glances and whispers. She wished Fred or Mary was there with her. But they were both on the line, so Mary could point him out to Fred. She heard the first group come in, the voices, the trays sliding down the serving line. She listened for one voice in particular, a voice forever burned into her mind. Fred and Mary stood beside one another, doling out scoops of reconstituted scrambled eggs and oatmeal. As men passed, Fred would glance at Mary for any indication. It wasn't until the second shift that Fred caught Mary's eye. She saw him in line. The toothpick was the giveaway. He was talking to a woman who also wore the uniform of the security staff. When the woman turned around, Fred saw that it was Singer. When they made their way to Mary and Fred's station, Singer said with a sneer,
Well, look who it is. Wind enough to get yourself a cushy job, huh?
When neither of them replied, she continued, But then I guess you're doing what you should be.
A glorified version of a waitress at Denny's.
Fred scooped the runniest eggs from the back of the pan and poured them onto her tray. Singer looked at the slimy mess with a frown, but didn't say anything. Even for the staff, complaining about the food was taboo. Next, the man stepped up, pulling the toothpick from his mustache.
Hello, darling.
Fred smiled, but her stomach was churning with anxiety.
Would you like some eggs?
Sure.
He looked at the pan.
Give me some of the firm ones there.
Fred scooped the firmest eggs in the pan and gently tapped them out on his tray. He smiled.
Why, thank you.
Fred smiled back.
Sure thing.
He slowly nodded his head, put the pick back in his teeth, and winked at her. Fred's skin was crawling. She felt like a baby zebra being sized up by a lion. She waited until they were seated, then dropped her serving spoon so she could go back to the kitchen for a replacement.
He's out there,
Fred whispered as she passed Jess. Jess stopped what she was doing, her heart in her throat. Fred got a new spoon and took it back to the line, sticking it in the eggs. Mary picked up the spoon, using one hand to serve eggs and the other for the oatmeal. Going back into the kitchen, Fred picked up a large pitcher of coffee and took it out to the dining area. She went around the tables, topping off cups and smiling at everyone. Making her way to the table with Singer and her friend, she filled a couple of cups before getting to him.
Want some more coffee?
He leaned back, looking her up and down. Why, sure thing. We must be special to be getting table service. Just my way of saying thanks for what you guys do.
She reached for his cup, knocking it on the floor.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll get you another one.
Singer was shaking her head.
See, I told you. Useless.
Calm down. It was an accident, he said.
I'll be right back with another cup.
Well, aren't you going to offer me any? Singer asked.
Fred was tempted. Oh, so tempted. Take her cup to the back, too. But two people falling dead would look suspicious.
She filled Singer's cup and headed for the kitchen. She grabbed a clean cup and took it into the storage room, where she poured half of the brown liquid into the cup, using a spoon to scrape it out, then poured some sugar on top. Passing by Jess, she jerked her head toward the dining area and went out with a cup and pitcher in hand. Jess watched through a crack in the door as Fred poured coffee into the cup. He was smiling and talking to her.
I even put a little sugar in it to make it sweet, like me, Fred said, handing him the cup.
Oh, whatever, Singer groaned.
If it's half as sweet as you, it'll rot my teeth.
Fred giggled. He doesn't know the half of it. Jess watched as he put the cup to his lips and took a sip. She didn't know what to expect. Was he going to grab his throat and foam at the mouth? Or clutch his chest and keel over? What she didn't expect was what happened. Nothing. He continued to talk to Fred as she went down the table, filling cups, finally making her way back to the kitchen. Putting the pitcher down, she joined Jess at the door.
Nothing's happening. It isn't working, Jess whispered urgently. Give it a minute. It will.
With their breakfast done, they watched as he stood, draining the cup in the process. As he walked toward the door, he stumbled, falling into Singer, who pushed him off.
Don't try your shit on me, she yelled.
He grabbed at the frame of the tent for support. For an instant, it seemed like he recovered, shaking his head and saying something. Then his back arched, and he fell over.
Oh, my God, Jess said in a whisper. You did it. Dead as a damn doornail, Fred whispered back.
The dining hall became a flurry of commotion, a crush of bodies heading toward him. Fred stepped through the door, watching as they tried to revive him. Then she saw Singer, who was looking right at Fred. She grabbed the arm of another security officer and pointed at her. Fred dipped back into the kitchen, and Jess ran from the door. Crashing through the door, Singer shouted,
"What did you do?
What did you put in that coffee?" Fred stood there in shock.
I didn't do anything. I gave you the same coffee. I gave it to everyone out there.
Singer moved toward the table, picking up the pitcher. She smelled it, then looked at the other guard.
Smell this.
He did.
Smells all right to me.
She filled my cup and I'm fine.
No. I know this sneaky little bitch did something.
She stepped toward Fred and thrust the pitcher out to her.
Drink it!
Fred took the pitcher and started drinking, her mouth curling into a smile as she did, coffee running out of the corners of her mouth. Draining the last bit, she set the pitcher on the table and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand.
Satisfied?
The man said,
I told you.
Quit overreacting, Singer. You're always looking to cause a ruckus. Singer stepped closer to Fred.
I know you did something, and when I find out what it is, your ass is mine.
As Singer took a step back, Fred let out a loud burp, quickly slapping her hand over her mouth. Through her fingers, she said,
Sorry.
The other guard was trying hard to stifle a laugh as a look of pure disgust passed over Singer's face. She wheeled around and stormed out of the kitchen. Jess came out of her hiding place after she left.
I can't believe it. It worked. It actually worked.
She had tears in her eyes. Mary came through the door, her eyes wide.
Guys, she whispered, he's dead.
Shh, don't talk about this here. As the body was being removed from the dining hall, they cleaned up, going through their normal routine. They were finishing up when Kay came walking over.
I don't suppose you three know anything about this? Mary shook her head, feigning shock. Fred replied,
No, why would we?
Mary said she heard people say he had a heart attack. Kay slowly shook her head and whispered,
I hope you know what you're doing.
Kay, really? We didn't do anything. How would we? We were working here all morning, serving the same food to him as everyone else.
I certainly hope so, Kay said, then left.
Come on, let's get out of here, Fred said, heading for the door. They went back to the room, each in their own thoughts. Once there, Jess lay out in her bunk, and Fred climbed up on hers and stretched out as well. Mary paced around the small room.
Sit down or something, Mary, Fred said.
I'm sorry, I'm just scared.
Why?
They know we did it.
No, they might think we did, but they don't know. Besides, you didn't do anything.
I'm still scared. She paced some more, then went to her locker.
I'm going to go take a shower.
Fred and Jess didn't speak about what had happened. Fred felt good about herself. Justice was done. It felt good to fight back. She wanted to sleep, but was too keyed up to. So she hopped out of bed and picked up a deck of cards, sitting down to play solitaire. Fred was almost through all four suits when the door opened. She turned, just in time to see Singer and three other people rush into the small space. Singer grabbed Fred by the neck and shoved her face onto the table, as someone else pulled her arms behind her back. Two other people were wrestling with Jess.
I told you I'd be back to get your ass, Singer said in her ear.
What the fuck? What are you doing? Fred shouted. Singer looked over as the other two fought with Jess. She was on her back, putting up a hell of a fight.
Come on, get her cuffed already, Singer shouted.
Jess drove a heel into the groin of one of the two men, forcing a loud groan from him. He collapsed on the floor with his hand between his legs.
Oh, for Christ's sake, move, Singer said, grabbing the other man's shoulder and pulling him out of the way.
Jess looked up at Singer, a bright red light between them. Then there was a pop, and Jess went rigid as the taser sent 50,000 volts coursing into her. The male guard quickly flipped her over and cuffed her hands behind her back. Fred tried to stand, but was shoved back into her seat.
What the hell are you doing? Why are you doing this?
Singer removed the spent cartridge from the weapon, dropping it on the floor.
You think you can kill one of us and get away with it? Look around. Where do you think you are?
We didn't do anything, Fred screamed in her face.
Oh, no?
Singer nodded to one of the guards who stepped out the door. He returned with Mary, who was crying and looked like shit.
Your little friend here already gave your ass up. All you bitches are gonna pay now.
Fred looked at Mary.
What?
Through her bawling, Mary said,
I'm sorry. She grabbed me when I was in the shower. I'm so sorry.
You sick bitch. What did you do to her?
What did I do? I'll show you what I did.
Singer jammed the taser onto Fred's neck and pulled the trigger, pushing her to the floor as she convulsed from the electricity. Fred let out a wail of pain.
How do you like that, huh? You like that?
Fred lay there, moaning as Mary wailed.
I'm sorry, Fred. I'm so sorry.
Get her up, Singer shouted. Fred was jerked from the floor and dragged out the door past Mary. The other two dragged Jess out and piled them into a Hummer. Mary was pushed in on top of them, and the truck drove off. They drove to the far side of the camp and stopped. When the doors opened, they were pushed to the ground.
Get up!
Singer shouted as she roughly pulled Fred to her feet. They were led through barbed wire gates and taken into a building, the likes of which they hadn't seen anywhere in the camp. Once inside, they were each placed in a small room where the cuffs were removed. Then, they were ordered to strip off their clothes. Male officers watched as they undressed and were forced to bend over in front of them and spread their cheeks. After this humiliation, they were told to squat down and cough three times. Then the officer ran his fingers through their hair and made them open their mouths and move their tongues around. Once the search was over, They were given orange jumpsuits with prisoner stenciled on the back. Before she could even finish putting it on, Jess was forced out of her room, a black bag quickly pulled over her head. Terrified, she listened as chains were dragged across the concrete floor. A chain was secured around her waist and her hands cuffed to it. She could feel as a set of leg irons were secured around her ankles. Her heart beat in her ears and she felt nauseous. She could hear Mary crying and Fred yelling, but she was bound in place, unable to move. Tears rolled down her cheeks.
"Get off me, fucker!" she heard Fred shout.
There was the sound of a struggle, and then the sound of a hard blow. Jess heard Fred moan and fall to the ground, then the sound of chains being dragged across the floor. There was a scuffling sound, and she assumed they were dragging Fred. Then Mary was brought out, still crying. She offered no resistance and was soon restrained as well.
"Jess, I'm sorry," Mary sobbed. "Shut up," a voice shouted. "Prisoners are not allowed to speak."
The only sound was of boots grinding in the concrete and Mary's pitiful crying. Jess was shoved from behind.
"Move!"
She nearly fell, the shackles only allowing her to take small steps. She was led along, and a door opened, and even with the bag over her head, she could tell she was outside. A hand grabbed her by the waist chain and pulled her along. She heard what sounded like a metal door slamming open, and she was shoved, almost losing her balance in the process.
"What'd this one do?" "They say she killed one of our guys."
"Is that so?" Suddenly, she yelled out as a kick to the back of her knees sent her falling to the floor.
"Don't move till the door closes."
It was slammed shut, and she was in total darkness. She lay on the floor and listened as two more doors were opened and the same statement made. Then, they slammed shut. An all-enveloping silence filled the place. Jess sat up, her hands straining at the chains. She leaned down and after several tries managed to get the hood off. It made no difference, though. The room she was in was completely black, giving her a sense of vertigo. She exhaled slowly, listening to the sound of her breathing. Once again, a familiar thought passed through her mind. "What have I gotten myself into?" Chapter 37. Ted stepped out of the woods onto the trail, and we stopped. Sarge called Mike on the radio and told him to bring the buggies up.
"What do you think?" Ted asked.
Sarge unfolded the map and handed it to him. Ted looked it over.
"Pretty good drawing."
"Yeah. Old boy said he was a surveyor."
"Hmm.
Hmm, what?"
Sarge asked, annoyed with the tone.
"It's just too good. I mean, this has distances marked on it. A compass rose up here in the corner." "He said he was a surveyor. If you're thinking it could be some sort of setup, then why didn't they already hit us? Why wait and see if we actually show up?"
Ted nodded.
"Well, that makes sense, I guess. How'd he get out?"
Sarge relayed the story Omar told of his escape and what happened to the ones captured afterwards as Mike and Doc drove up in the buggies.
"Somebody call a taxi?" Mike shouted. "Let's get out of here. I need to go talk with Sheffield."
I climbed in the buggy with Doc, looking back at Taylor. "Well, how was it?"
"Boring. Also, I had to pee behind a tree in the woods, and I never want to do that again."
I laughed as Doc started to drive off. We were turning around when a rip of automatic weapon fire sounded off to our north. While it wasn't on top of us, it was too close for comfort. Mike stopped abruptly, and Doc slammed on the brakes to keep from crashing into him. Sarge came over the radio.
"Sounds like our friends are in some trouble."
The volume of fire intensified. I keyed my mic.
"Should we go help them?"
"Let's go check it out," Sarge replied.
We slowly made our way toward the sound of the shooting. From the direction it was coming from, they must be on Highway 40. As we crawled up a small hill, Sarge's buggy stopped and the mast started to rise.
"What's that?"
Taylor asked, pointing to the top of the mast.
"It's a camera," I replied.
"Really? That's cool. Can we go up and see it?"
Just hang on. I got a view. Come on up here and take a look, Sarge called. We all climbed out and went up to Sarge's side. He had the little console in his lap. On the small screen, we could see the blazer on the north side of the road. The doors were open, and muzzle flashes were coming from under it. Sarge panned the camera to the left. Two Humvees sat in the road with gunners in their turrets, laying down a steady stream of fire.
They better move. They're maneuvering on them, Ted said, pointing to the corner of the screen where uniformed men were cautiously working their way down the shoulder of the road.
We need to go help them. Try to draw fire off them, I said.
Nah, we aren't doing that, Sarge said.
Why the hell not? They came out here to bring you some info. You're not going to try and save their asses?
We gotta pick our fights, and this ain't one.
I was getting pissed. What do you mean it ain't one? They're on our side in this shit. We need to support our friends. Sarge launched himself out of the seat with more agility than I would have ever thought a man of his age had.
Damn it, Morgan! You don't think I want to help them? You don't think I want to wait out there and kick some ass? We can't stand toe-to-toe and fight these bastards. We've got to pick when and where, and do it on our terms. Didn't that little shootout that forced you out of your home teach you anything?
It just doesn't seem right. They're willing to fight the good fight. To leave them there to get their asses shot seems wrong.
Well, not everyone wins. Not everyone goes home. They may pay the price today, but there isn't shit we can do about it right now. Instead, we're going to watch and see how these bastards operate, what they do. That way, if they do get wasted today, it won't be for nothing. They'll be teaching us.
Sarge climbed back in the buggy and went back to watching the screen. During our argument, Taylor had backed away. I could see her out of the corner of my eye, looking uncomfortable. The guy sat through the argument as though nothing were happening, but I guess they're used to it. On the screen, the DHS goons closed in on the group, and soon the shooting stopped. Two men were dragged out from behind the blazer and forced to kneel on the road with their hands over their heads.
"Let's see what they do now," Sarge said.
We watched as they were searched. I could see Calvin shouting at them. The other must have been Shane, his son. I wondered where Daniel was. Calvin was pushed to the ground and his hands secured behind his back. He was still yelling, and one of the DHS men came up with a piece of duct tape and put it over his mouth. Then, black hoods were pulled over both of their heads. Calvin was dragged toward one of the Humvees, and then Shane was too, kicking and screaming.
"Looks like they're going by the book,"
Sarge said, more to himself than to anyone else.
"What book?" I asked. "Ted, what do you remember from Field Manual 339.40? That's the Internment Resettlement Manual, isn't it?"
"Yep, that's it."
"Something about the five S's," Mike said.
"Yep. What were they, remember?"
"Let's see. Shit, shower, and shave. I know those," Mike said with a grin to Taylor. She thought it was funny and smiled back.
"Shut up, stupid," Sarge said, causing Taylor to laugh out loud before clamping a hand over her mouth. Mike looked over and shrugged.
"Search, silence, and segregate," Ted said. "I can't remember the other two."
"Speed and safeguard," Sarge said. "They've already done the first three. The last two don't really matter right now."
"I can't believe we just sat here and let them be taken like that," I said.
"If we'd have tried to help, then we'd be right beside them, Morg."
Once the search was over, one of the DHS men pulled the pin on some kind of grenade and tossed it before running off. There was a small explosion, more of a pop, and the truck rapidly caught fire. Soon it was burning intensely, and we could see the smoke over the trees. Sarge panned the camera around some more.
"See any bodies?"
"No, I was curious too. They only took two away, but I don't see any," Ted said.
"I wonder where the guys in the ATVs are," Mike said.
"Good question. Let's wait a bit and see if they show up."
Taylor tapped me on the shoulder. She said she was scared and wanted to go home.
"We will soon. It's all right. They don't know we're here. What if those guys tell them?"
I was surprised by the question. She was smarter about this than I thought. Sarge answered it for her. They didn't, or those guys would already be here looking for us. They might later, but not right now.
We waited about an hour, but the ATVs never showed. We discussed whether we should go out and check the scene, but we decided the chances that someone was left behind was too big a risk. We all mounted up and headed back toward the river, leaving the smoking carcass behind. The trip back would pose a bit more peril, as we would be traveling in broad daylight. With this in mind, I told Taylor to watch her side, keeping an eye out for people. She took it seriously and turned slightly, keeping the muzzle of the H&K pointed out. On the ride, I noticed for the first time that it was considerably warmer now. I leaned my head back and watched as the light winked through the canopy of trees. The smells of the forest wafted around us, pine, oak, dirt. It was peaceful for a moment, at least until the buggy lurched to a stop, bringing me back around to the reality of where I was. "What's up?" I asked. "The paved road is up ahead. Ted's going to walk up and check it out," Doc replied. "Is something wrong?" Taylor asked. "No, it's just a precaution." She nodded and went back to watching her side of the buggy. I watched Ted disappear down the trail. After 5 or so minutes, he called over the radio, giving the all clear. We pulled up, and he hopped back in with Sarge. Once on the other side of the road, we only had one more to cross. At the second road, we stopped to repeat the process. This time, Ted called for Sarge to come up. I was curious, so I hopped out too. "Dad, can I come?" Taylor asked. "Sure. I don't think it's anything big. Come on." We walked up to the road to find Ted standing just inside the tree line.
"What's up?"
Sarge asked. Ted pointed up the road.
"It's the neighborhood Fruit Loop."
Up the road, standing on the center lane, was the guy from Alexander Springs. He had his arms out like he was balancing himself, walking on the yellow line.
"I think that old boy's nuttier than squirrel shit," Sarge said, shaking his head. "But I don't think he's anything to worry about."
"I think he's been alone too long," I said. Sarge turned to go back to the vehicles.
"Come on, let's get back."
"Who was it?" Taylor asked when I got back.
"Just that weird dude we saw at the park."
We started across the road. The guy was still in the middle of the road. His back was to us, and after a few steps, he turned about, facing us. Sarge was already across the road when the nut job drew a pistol. I watched as he raised it and fired a shot, with a joker-like smile on his face. Taylor screamed and ducked, and my arm flew out instinctively to protect her. When the shot rang out, Sarge floored it, as did Doc. There wasn't any time to react to it. We were gone as fast as it happened.
"Who the fuck was that?"
Sarge shouted over the radio.
"It was that damn crazy guy out walking in the road," I answered.
"He shot at us?"
"Yeah. As we were crossing, he drew a pistol and loosed a round. He was smiling the whole time. We'll have to deal with him later, friggin' nut."
We made it the rest of the way without any issues. As we pulled up beside the cabin, I saw Thad, Danny, and Jeff skinning a hog that was hanging upside down from the limb of a big oak tree. Thad and Danny were on either side of the animal, working knives, cutting the hide away. Jeff was cutting chunks of fat from the hide and dropping them in a bucket. I smiled when I saw Little Bit poking the gut pile with a stick. Taylor and I walked over. She scrunched up her face. "That is so gross." Little Bit lifted up a stick with a piece of intestine on it.
"Taylor, I'm going to eat your brains."
Taylor squealed and ran in the opposite direction of her sister.
"So, we smoking a pig today?" I asked.
Thad smiled and wiped his forehead with the back of his hand.
"Yeah, I'm going to smoke it tonight, good and slow."
"Cool. That'll be some good meat."
"Why now, though?"
"You couldn't wait to use a real smoker, I bet." He pointed off in the direction of the pigs.
"I think that sow's carrying a litter," he said, then slapped the ham of the one strung up. "This boy here has been cut, so I figured we can go ahead and butcher him to give that mama a little more feed. Plus, we can use the meat," Danny said.
Sarge and the guys strolled up.
Damn, I can't wait for some of that porker, Sarge said.
Thad smiled again.
Yeah, we even found some sauce for it. Morgan had a few bottles and some of that mess under the cabin. But for now, we're going to make up a brine and soak the meat for a few hours. Then I'll get it on the smoke, Thad said.
Can't wait, Sarge added. I'm going to have to go down to the creek and meet with that guard captain. We'll be back before dark.
You need me? Mike asked.
Nah. You want to stay here?
Yeah, I'll help the guys out with the wonderful pork goodness.
Fine by me. Doc, you want to go?
Sure. I haven't been down there. I'll go.
All right, then. Let's load up. We got some planning to do.
Sergeant Doc headed down the river. Smoke from the outboard drifted on top of the water like a fog. I watched them as they left, marveling at the fortune that brought us all together. I looked at Thad and thought for a moment about the terrible losses he'd suffered. And yet here he was skinning a pig with a smile on his face.
Danny was Danny. He was upset about his house, but looking at him, you'd never know.
He was very stoic, and his face never revealed his emotions. And his wife, Bobby, was just as solid as he was when it came to adversity. Jeff, kneeling beside the bucket, was probably the least affected among us, as far as I knew. He was perpetually upbeat. Nothing ever seemed to bother him. I remembered that night on the road, watching him methodically kill those men. He was completely emotionless, performing the task as if it were any ordinary chore.
Then there was Mike. He was younger than the rest of us here, but his life in the army had made him wise beyond his years in the business of death. Together with Sarge, Ted, and Doc, he was a formidable force. Mike's youthful exuberance was contagious, and he was always fun to have around.
Even now, only hours after watching the gruesome incidents of this morning, he was beside Little Bit, playing in a gut pile. She would squeal and laugh when he picked up the organs, cutting a lung loose and blowing it up like a balloon. I looked over to the cabin where Mel and the other girls were staying. Mel and I obviously had our differences about moving here, but she was holding our family together, and for that I was grateful. Taylor and Leanne were still coping well. Leanne had rebounded from the shooting better than I thought. She seemed unfazed by the fact she had taken a bullet to the leg. Before, I could only imagine the drama and therapy such a situation would require. Taylor, unlike her sister, seemed to be gravitating toward the worst of this new life. Her interest in firearms and wanting to venture away from the relative safety of our little cabins on the river were a real concern. In the before, my girls were always good. No trouble with boys, drugs, or drinking. The only addiction they ever had was to technology. The internet, iTunes, and whatnot were their constant companions. They were of that generation, the ones born into these things. To them, Googling something was second nature, not like when I grew up and the encyclopedia held all the answers. Hell, they had no idea what an encyclopedia was. But even without their technological luxuries, they were rolling with the punches. It was easiest on Little Bit. She was young enough that the stuff hadn't been too big a part of her life yet. Food. Food is always on everyone's mind. Maybe this is how it used to be, but we've gotten into the habit of eating only twice a day. Not because of a lack of food, really. More because of the effort acquiring and preparing a meal took in our primitive condition. We weren't starving, but food preservation wasn't what it once was. We did have a DC fridge run by the solar system, but it was small. Small as it may be, it was a godsend. I would venture to guess we were the only ones for 100, maybe 200 miles with a working fridge. While life was simpler, it was physically harder. Maybe that's how we're supposed to live. Maybe we'd grown soft in our technological wonder of a life. For better or worse, for now, and for the foreseeable future, that wonder was gone. In the now, we had to try and recover some of the lost wisdom of those who came before us. I only hoped we were half as ingenious as they were. Epilogue.
Sarge sat back in his chair, crossing his arms over his chest, and looked at Sheffield.
What do you think?
Sheffield looked at the crudely drawn map on the table before him.
I think we need a little more info. It's a big-ass target.
You've got enough men. We'll have to hit them hard and fast. Use the shock to our advantage.
Sheffield rubbed his chin.
I don't know. We have any idea how many men they got in there?
Nothing realistic. We're going to have to do some recon first to get an idea of their strength.
That I agree with. We're definitely going to have to get some eyes on it. I wish we had some assets we could use.
Sarge sat up, leaning his elbows on the table.
I have a little something.
Sheffield raised his eyebrows.
Really? What? I've got a recon vehicle, like a big ATV. It's got a mast I can put up with a camera. Night vision and thermal capable. If we find the right place, we can stand off and have eyes on the target.
I like that. Keep some distance between us and them.
Sheffield looked at the map again and tapped it with his finger.
I'd like to make a more accurate map, too. Draw something with a little more detail.
We can do that. One of my guys has been through the Marine Scout Sniper School. I'll let him take care of that, Sarge said.
Sheffield nodded.
One of our guys has been through it, too. Maybe we could team them up and let them handle the recon. They can do the best range drawing, estimate ranges and all.
That's a good idea. Send a small security detail with them. Maybe keep a quick reaction force nearby in case they get their dicks caught in their zippers.
Excellent. So a little more intel, and we'll get a plan in action.
Sheffield sat back in his chair.
When do you want to start?
Sarge stood up with a grin on his face.
Soon as you can get that Marine dressed and his hair combed.
This is Duke Fontaine. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Escaping Home. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Dion Audio. Escaping Home is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group, USA, LLC, a Penguin Random House company. Copyright 2013, all rights reserved. The book, Escaping Home, is available wherever Plume books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.